Chapter 8. After parking the department's speedy, beefed-up hover car on the roof of the San Francisco Hall of Justice on Lombard Street, bounty hunter Rick Deckard, briefcase in hand, descended to Harry Bryant's office. "You're back awfully soon," his superior said, leaning back in his chair and taking a pinch of specific number one snuff. "I got what you sent me for." Rick seated himself facing the desk. He set his briefcase down. "I'm tired," he realized. It had begun to hit him now that he had gotten back. He wondered if he would be able to recoup enough for the job ahead. "How's Dave?" he asked. "Well enough for me to go talk to him? I want to before I tackle the first of the Andes." Bryant said, "You'll be trying for Polakoff first. The one that lasered Dave. Best to get him right out of it, since he knows we've got him listed." "Before I talk to Dave?" Bryant reached for a sheet of onion skin paper, a blurred third or fourth carbon. "Polakoff has taken a job with the city as a trash collector, a scavenger." "Don't only specials do that kind of work?" "Polakoff is mimicking a special, an anthead. Very deteriorated, or so he pretends to be. That's what suckered Dave. Polakoff apparently looks and acts so much like an anthead that Dave forgot." "Are you sure about the Voight-Kampff scale now?" "You're absolutely certain, from what happened up in Seattle, that..." "I am," Rick said shortly. He did not amplify. Bryant said, "I'll take your word for it. But there can't be even one slip-up." "There never could be in Andy hunting. This is no different." "The Nexus 6 is different." "I already found my first one," Rick said. "And Dave found two. Three, if you count Polakoff." "Okay, I'll retire Polakoff today, and then maybe tonight or tomorrow talk to Dave." He reached for the blurred carbon, the poop sheet on the android Polakoff. "One more item," Bryant said. "A Soviet cop from the WPO is on his way here. While you were in Seattle, I got a call from him. He's aboard an Aeroflot rocket that'll touch down at the public field here in about an hour. Sandor Kadalyi, his name is." "What's he want?" Rarely, if ever, did WPO cops show up in San Francisco. "WPO is enough interested in the new Nexus 6 types that they want a man of theirs to be with you. An observer. And also, if he can, he'll assist you. It's for you to decide when and if he can be of value. But I've already given him permission to tag along." "What about the bounty?" Rick said. "You won't have to split it," Bryant said, and smiled creakily. "I just wouldn't regard it as financially fair." He had absolutely no intention of sharing his winnings with a thug from WPO. He studied the poop sheet on Polakoff. It gave a description of the man, or rather the Andy, and his current address and place of business. The Bay Area Scavengers Company, with offices on Geary. "Want to wait on the Polakoff retirement until the Soviet cop gets here to help you?" Bryant asked. Rick bristled. "I've always worked alone. Of course, it's your decision. I'll do whatever you say. But I'd just as soon tackle Polakoff right now, without waiting for Kadalyi to hit town." "You go ahead on your own," Bryant decided. "And then on the next one, which shall be a Miss Luba Luft. You have the sheet there on her, too. You can bring in Kadalyi." Having stuffed the onion skin carbons in his briefcase, Rick left his superior's office and ascended once more to the roof and his parked hover car. And now let's visit Mr. Polakoff, he said to himself. He padded his laser tube. For his first try at the android Polakoff, Rick stopped off at the offices of the Bay Area Scavengers Company. I'm looking for an employee of yours, he said to the severe, gray-haired switchboard woman. The scavenger's building impressed him. Large and modern, it held a good number of high-class, purely office employees. The deep pile carpets, the expensive, genuine wood desks reminded him that garbage collecting and trash disposal had, since the war, become one of Earth's important industries. The entire planet had begun to disintegrate into junk, and to keep the planet habitable for the remaining population, the junk had to be hauled away occasionally. Or, as Buster Friendly liked to declare, Earth would die under a layer not of radioactive dust, but of kipple. Mr. Ackers, the switchboard woman informed him. He's the personnel manager. She pointed to an impressive but imitation oak desk at which sat a prissy, tiny, bespectacled individual, merged with his plethora of paperwork. Rick presented his police ID. Where's your employee Polakoff right now? At his job or at home? After reluctantly consulting his records, Mr. Ackers said, Polakoff ought to be at work, flattening hover cars at our Daly City plant and dumping them into the bay. However, the personnel manager consulted a further document, then picked up his vidphone and made an inside call to someone else in the building. He's not, then, he said, terminating the call. Hanging up, he said to Rick, Polakoff didn't show up for work today. No explanation. What's he done, officer? If he should show up, Rick said, don't tell him I was here asking about him. You understand? Yes, I understand, Ackers said sulkily, as if his deep schooling in police matters had been derided. In the department's beefed-up hover car, Rick next flew to Polakoff's apartment building in the Tenderloin. We'll never get him, he told himself. They, Bryant and Holden, waited too long. Instead of sending me to Seattle, Bryant should have sicked me on Polakoff. Better still, last night, as soon as Dave Holden got his. What a grimy place, he observed as he walked across the roof to the elevator. Abandoned animal pens, encrusted with months of dust. And in one cage, a no longer functioning false animal. A chicken. By elevator, he descended to Polakoff's floor, found the hall unlit like a subterranean cave. Using his police A-powered sealed beam light, he illuminated the hall and once again glanced over the onion skin carbon. The Voight-Kampff tests had been administered to Polakoff. That part could be bypassed, and he could go directly to the task of destroying the android. Best to get him from out here, he decided. Setting down his weapons kit, he fumbled it open, got out a non-directional Penfield wave transmitter. He punched the key for catalepsy, himself protected against the mood emanation by means of a counterwave broadcast through the transmitter's metal hull, directed to him alone. They're now all frozen stiff, he said to himself, as he shut off the transmitter. Everyone, human and Andy alike, in the vicinity. No risk to me. All I have to do is walk in and laser him. Assuming, of course, that he's in his apartment, which isn't likely. Using an infinity key, which analyzed and opened all forms of locks known, he entered Polakoff's apartment, laser beam in hand. No, Polakoff. Only semi-ruined furniture, a place of kipple and decay. In fact, no personal articles. What greeted him consisted of unclaimed debris which Polakov had inherited when he took the apartment, and which, in leaving, he had abandoned to the next, if any, tenant. "I knew it," he said to himself. "Well, there goes the first $1,000 bounty. Probably skipped all the way to the Antarctic Circle. Out of my jurisdiction. Another bounty hunter from another police department will retire Polakov and claim the money. On, I suppose, to the Andes who haven't been warned, as was Polakov. On to Luba Luft. Back again on the roof in his hover car, he reported by phone to Harry Bryant. No luck on Polakov. Left probably right after he lasered Dave. He inspected his wristwatch. Want me to pick up Kedalyi at the field? It'll save time, and I'm eager to get started on Miss Luft. He already had the poop sheet on her laid out before him, had begun a thorough study of it. Good idea, Bryant said. Except that Mr. Kedalyi is already here. His Aeroflot ship, as usual, he says, arrived early. Just a moment. An invisible conference. He'll fly over and meet you where you are now, Bryant said, returning to the screen. Meanwhile, read up on Miss Luft. An opera singer. Allegedly from Germany. At present attached to the San Francisco Opera Company. He nodded in reflexive agreement, his mind on the poop sheet. Must have a good voice to make connections so fast. Okay, I'll wait here for Kedalyi. He gave Bryant his location and rang off. I'll pose as an opera fan, Rick decided as he read further. I particularly would like to see her as Donna Anna in Don Giovanni. In my personal collection, I have tapes by such old-time greats as Elizabeth Schwarzkopf and Lotta Lehmann and Lisa Della Casa. That'll give us something to discuss while I set up my Voight Kampf equipment. His car phone buzzed. He picked up the receiver. The police operator said, Mr. Decker, to call for you from Seattle. Mr. Bryant said to put it through to you. From the Rosen Association. Okay, Rick said, and waited. What do they want? He wondered. As far as he could discern, the Rosens had already proven to be bad news, and undoubtedly would continue so, whatever they intended. Rachel Rosen's face appeared on the tiny screen. Hello, Officer Deckard. Her tone seemed placating. That caught his attention. Are you busy right now, or can I talk to you? Go ahead, he said. We of the association have been discussing your situation regarding the escaped Nexus 6 types, and knowing them as we do, we feel that you'll have better luck if one of us works in conjunction with you.
By doing what?
Well, by one of us coming along with you, when you go out looking for them.
Why? What would you add?
Rachel said, the Nexus Sixes would be wary at being approached by a human. But if another Nexus Six made the contact,
you specifically mean yourself?
Yes.
She nodded, her face sober. I've got too much help already.
But I really think you need me.
I doubt it. I'll think it over and call you back. At some distant, unspecified future time, he said to himself. Or more likely, never. That's all I need. Rachel Rosen popping up through the dust at every step.
You don't really mean it, Rachel said. You'll never call me.
You don't realize how agile an illegal escaped Nexus 6 is, how impossible it'll be for you. We feel we owe you this because of, you know, what we did.
I'll take it under advisement. He started to hang up.
Without me, Rachel said, one of them will get you before you can get it.
Goodbye, he said, and hung up. What kind of world is it, he asked himself, when an android phones up a bounty hunter and offers him assistance? He rang the police operator back.
Don't put any more calls through to me from Seattle, he said.
Yes, Mr. Deckard. Has Mr. Kadalyi reached you yet?
I'm still waiting. And he had better hurry because I'm not going to be here long. Again, he hung up. As he resumed reading the poop sheet on Luba Luft, a hover car taxi spun down to land on the roof a few yards off. From it, a red-faced, cherubic-looking man, evidently in his mid-50s, wearing a heavy and impressive Russian-style greatcoat, stepped and, smiling, his hand extended, approached Rick's car.
Mr. Deckard, the man asked with a Slavic accent, the bounty hunter for the San Francisco Police Department.
The empty taxi rose, and the Russian watched it go absently.
I'm Sandor Kadalyi,
the man said, and opened the car door to squeeze in beside Rick. As he shook hands with Kadalyi, Rick noticed that the WPO representative carried an unusual type of laser tube, a subform which he had never seen before.
Oh, this, Kadalyi said. Interesting, isn't it?
He tugged it from his belt holster.
I got this on Mars.
I thought I knew every handgun made, Rick said. Even those manufactured at and for use in the colonies.
We made this ourselves, Kadalyi said, beaming like a Slavic Santa, his ruddy face inscribed with pride. You like it? What is different about it functionally is... Here, take it.
He passed the gun over to Rick, who inspected it expertly, by way of years of experience.
How does it differ functionally? Rick asked.
He couldn't tell.
Press the trigger.
Aiming upward out the window of the car, Rick squeezed the trigger of the weapon. Nothing happened. No beam emerged. Puzzled, he turned to Kadalyi.
The triggering circuit, Kadalyi said cheerfully, isn't attached. It remains with me. You see?
He opened his hand, revealed a tiny unit.
And I can also direct it within certain limits, irrespective of where it's aimed.
You're not Polakov. You're Kadalyi, Rick said.
Don't you mean that the other way around? You're a bit confused.
I mean you're Polakov, the android. You're not from the Soviet police. Rick, with his toe, pressed the emergency button on the floor of his car.
Why won't my laser tube fire?
Kadalyi Polakov said, switching on and off the miniaturized triggering and aiming device which he held in the palm of his hand. A sine wave, Rick said, that phases out laser emanation and spreads the beam into ordinary light.
Then I'll have to break your pencil neck.
The android dropped the device and, with a snarl, grabbed with both hands for Rick's throat. As the android's hands sank into his throat, Rick fired his regulation-issue old-style pistol from its shoulder holster. The 38 Magnum slug struck the android in the head and its brain box burst. The Nexus 6 unit which operated it blew into pieces, a raging, mad wind which carried throughout the car.
bits of it, like the radioactive dust itself whirled down on Rick. The retired remains of the android rocked back, collided with the car door, bounced off and struck heavily against him. He found himself struggling to shove the twitching remnants of the android away. Shakily, he at last reached for the car phone, called in to the Hall of Justice. "Shall I make my report?" he said. "Tell Harry Bryant that I got Polakoff."
"You got Polakoff? He'll understand that, will he?"
"Yes," Rick said, and hung up. "Christ, that came close," he said to himself. "I must have overreacted to Rachel Rosen's warning. I went the other way, and it almost finished me. But I got Polakoff," he said to himself. His adrenal gland, by degrees, ceased pumping its several secretions into his bloodstream. His heart slowed to normal, his breathing became less frantic, but he still shook. "Anyhow, I made myself $1,000 just now," he informed himself. "So it was worth it. And I'm faster to react than Dave Holden." Of course, however, Dave's experience evidently prepared me. That has to be admitted. Dave had not had such warning. Again picking up the phone, he placed a call home to his apt, to Erin. Meanwhile, he managed to light a cigarette. The shaking had begun to depart. His wife's face, sodden with the six-hour self-accusatory depression which she had prophesied, manifested itself on the vidscreen.
"Oh, hello, Rick.
What happened to the 594 I dialed for you before I left? Pleased acknowledgement of..."
"I redialed as soon as you left. What do you want?"
Her voice sank into a dreary drone of despond.
"I'm so tired, and I just have no hope left of anything. Of our marriage, and you possibly getting killed by one of those Andes. Is that what you want to tell me, Rick? That an Andy got you?"
In the background, the racket of Buster Friendly boomed and brayed, eradicating her words. He saw her mouth moving, but heard only the TV. "Listen," he broke in. "Can you hear me? I'm on to something. A new type of android that apparently nobody can handle but me. I've retired one already, so that's a grand to start with. You know what we're going to have before I'm through?" Erin stared at him sightlessly.
"Oh,"
she said, nodding. "I haven't said yet." He could tell now. Her depression this time had become too vast for her even to hear him. For all intents, he spoke into a vacuum. "I'll see you tonight," he finished bitterly and slammed the receiver down. "Damn her," he said to himself. "What good does it do, my risking my life? She doesn't care whether we own an ostrich or not. Nothing penetrates. I wish I had gotten rid of her 2 years ago when we were considering splitting up." "I can still do it," he reminded himself. Broodingly, he leaned down, gathered together on the car floor his crumpled papers, including the info on Luba Luft. "No support," he informed himself. "Most androids I've known have more vitality and desire to live than my wife. She has nothing to give me." That made him think of Rachel Rosen again. "Her advice to me as to the Nexus 6 mentality," he realized, "turned out to be correct. Assuming she doesn't want any of the bounty money, maybe I could use her. The encounter with Kedalyi Polakov had changed his ideas rather massively. Snapping on his hover car's engine, he whisked nippity-nip up into the sky, heading toward the old War Memorial Opera House, where, according to Dave Holden's notes, he would find Luba Luft this time of the day. He wondered now about her, too. Some female androids seemed to him pretty. He had found himself physically attracted by several, and it was an odd sensation, knowing intellectually that they were machines, but emotionally reacting anyhow. For example, Rachel Rosen. No, he decided. She's too thin. No real development, especially in the bust. A figure like a child's, flat and tame. He could do better. How old did the poop sheet say Luba Luft was? As he drove, he hauled out the now wrinkled notes, found her so-called age. 28, the sheet read. Judged by appearance, which, with Andy's, was the only useful standard. It's a good thing I know something about opera, Rick reflected. That's another advantage I have over Dave. I'm more culturally oriented. I'll try one more Andy before I ask Rachel for help, he decided. If Miss Luft proves exceptionally hard, but he had an intuition she wouldn't. Polakov had been the rough one. The others, unaware that anyone actively hunted them, would crumble in succession, plugged like a file of ducks. As he descended toward the ornate, expansive roof of the opera house, he loudly sang a potpourri of arias, with pseudo-Italian words made up on the spot by himself. Even without the Penfield mood organ at hand, his spirits brightened into optimism and into hungry, gleeful anticipation.